Welcome back to our course on critical theory, cultural studies, and postmodern theory. If you haven't noticed by now, we're tackling quite a big bear here in three major schools of thought, which could be treated each separately, but which we're undertaking a treatment of coterminously because they are so cognate and they have a kinship, but more so because of their combined effect. The three of them, I think, combined into what we might call, and I think is justifiably so, cultural Marxism, in the sense that they have together an intellectual, an ideological, a political criticism. They combine to form this criticism, which can be seen in contemporary society. Their combined effects, I think, can be noted in the contemporary world. And these effects combine to produce what I call cultural Marxism. It's called by others the same thing. It's deemed by the left as a conspiracy theory, but I'm trying to locate the actual roots of what this is. And I think they are found in these three schools, and that is why we are looking at them under the same aegis here in a single course. So let's go into this lecture after having discussed the three schools together and their orientation and so forth in lecture one. I went on to discuss the precursors of the Frankfurt School, in particular in lecture two, for the treatment of Hegel, Marx, and Lukács. Then in lecture three, I introduced the Frankfurt School itself, and we treated two of the major theorists in it, Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer. Then in lecture four, we treated Herbert Marcuse, one of the more practical, if not the most practical, theorists of the school, and someone, as I noted, has had a tremendous impact on the American left. So today we're going to do a critical conclusions, evaluation of the Frankfurt School. What is their effect? What have they undertaken? What has it led to? This is necessarily cursory in the sense that it's almost impossible to trace all of the effects that this school has had on the American left and on society in the West and in the U.S. It's just been so broad and persuasive in terms of what they've accomplished that it's almost impossible to trace all the various branches and so forth from that have emanated from this school of thought. But let's give it a try. It'll be necessarily somewhat of a short, but I think impactful, critical, concluding remarks. Set of critical concluding remarks. So, the Frankfurt School theorists infiltrated Western academia first and the state, as I noted with reference to Marcuse, from the mid-1930s on. So they emigrated from Germany in 1933. They set up shop at Columbia. Then some of them moved out to Berkeley. And in the case of Marcuse, ended up at Brandeis, but had a tour of the State Department as well. And they basically became a field of study in the West, in a particular in universities in the U.S. Various schools undertook and created departments basically devoted to the study of critical theory, mostly in English departments. They became sort of a subset of English. For example, where I went at Carnegie Mellon, it's the English department, and under the English department, there were three approaches or three subdisciplinary endeavors. One was not English literature, that was not one of them. The one was literary and cultural studies and theory, which is the one I studied, and then there's creative writing and professional writing. But the whole enterprise, otherwise known as English literature studies or English literature, has been completely outmoded in many universities and colleges throughout the country, and they've come to devote themselves to cultural studies and critical theory. Now, their ideas, the ideas of the Frankfurt School, coupled with the writing of the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci, may be considered the primary source of cultural Marxism. Antonio Gramsci was an Italian Marxist. He wrote while imprisoned under Franco the prison notebooks. In those prison notebooks, he developed his theory of hegemony, the idea that there was a capitalist ideological hegemony that dominated society, and that in order to undertake socialist revolution, what first had to take place was a ideological revolution in the spheres of ideological, the state apparatuses of ideological production, especially the academy and the media and so forth. In order to combat this capitalist hegemony with a socialist hegemony, and this would take what Gramsci called a long march through the institutions. Well, the Frankfurt School took that march, and there have many, many foot soldiers have followed behind. So combined with the Frankfurt School and Gramsci, and I would argue also cultural studies and postmodern theory, we have this nebulous but nevertheless identifiable movement called cultural Marxism. This is especially true of the writing of Herbert Marcuse. Because of its more activist bent, its more interventionist mode, and its belief in a project for revolution and its continuous arguing for it, rather than sort of reclining into a posture of negative intellectual armchair evaluation like part of the school, in the case of Max Horkheimer and especially Adorno, Marcuse kept the charge going. He kept it going, and he produced books, and especially one book, as I noted, One Dimensional Man, and his essay on repressive tolerance. These were very impactful on the left. They became some of the treatises that were most defining for the new left. Upon coming to the United States from Germany, one might say that the Frankfurt School viewed with horror the success of capitalism and saw everything in terms of what they had fled, fascism. So it seemed they projected back onto American society their nightmare regarding the rise of fascism in Germany. They seemed to see everything through a lens colored by that experience, so that they saw fascism everywhere, so that they saw American society as fascistic. And that is certainly partly responsible for this view on the left that capitalism is fascist, that American society is fascist, whereas principally speaking, it's otherwise. It's individualistic, which is the opposite of fascism, because fascism is collectivist. It was collectivist from the outset. It was collectivist in Italy. It was collectivist in Germany. And this is why I would say that figures like Nietzsche cannot be considered in terms of fascism, because he deplored groupthink and collectivism, which fascism was a particular movement of. So they came here, the Frankfurt School, and just saw everything in terms of what they fled. Thus, they figured Western capitalism as totalitarian. And how could they arrive at this? Well, it was totalizing. It was totalizing in the sense that it absorbed everything and that it left no room for criticism or outside standpoints, as they saw it. So they sort of conflated the idea of this totalizing aspect, as they saw it, with totalitarian rule, which I think is really hasty and quite a conflation that should not have been made, because totalitarianism is a dictatorial governmental operation that we haven't had in the United States. Now, if anything is becoming totalitarian, it's the left itself, just the irony of all this. When I read these texts written in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and some in the 70s from the Frankfurt School, and their descriptions of the right really fit perfectly with the left, whereas their descriptions of the left are all laughable in light of current circumstances. Rather than or while appreciating the relative comfort and security in the West, in the U.S., and we saw pictures of Herbert Marcuse and Adorno, you know, in relative comfort, in the case of Marcuse lounging on his chaise lounge and smoking a pipe. They lambasted the culture, society, and industries and wealth of Western capitalism. Cultural Marxism is a term that refers to revolution by another means, as I mentioned. This long march through the institutions, this ideological encounter, this ideological battle and war, if you will. The targets of cultural Marxism are the institutions of what they see as capitalist hegemony, the institutions that produce and reproduce the dominant ideology and practices and way of life of capitalism. And they included in those the academy, of course, the media, and corporations, even various ways of life, they would see as part of this capitalist hegemony that had to be opposed. The Frankfurt School's influence in this regard cannot be underestimated, in this ideological regard in particular. The impact of the Frankfurt School can be best understood in their own terms of negative dialectics, negative reason, negation, and negative thinking. Everything is about negation. And so their negative attitude, really, is a better way to put it all together, is there, the effects of their negative attitude really is, can sum up the effect of their entire program. Rather than providing any real positive program for change, they didn't have treatises that, you know, effectively said, as Marx did, what to do in 10 steps to initiate a socialist revolution. Instead, they undertook a continuous and continuing negative program of criticism, which has worked as a form of subversion, ideological subversion, just as Marcuse in particular had hoped. He wrote these words in particular explicitly, that he was working on subverting the established order. Their critical theory influenced the development of critical and scathing negative evaluations of American society, culture, economics, the legal system, race relations, politics, and impacted Western U.S. education in nearly inscrutable ways. That is, it cannot even be traced. It's so broad and pervasive. It's almost impossible to pinpoint everywhere and how these ways of thought have influenced and impacted education in the United States and elsewhere. It would not be a mistake, therefore, to consider the critical theory developed by the Frankfurt School as promoting what the Soviet KGB defector Yuri Bezmenov called ideological subversion. Although the Frankfurt School was not connected to Soviet communism in any traceable explicit ways in some instances critiqued it and criticized it, but not often. Nevertheless, they were involved in ideological subversion for socialism. Meanwhile, the criticism of enlightenment and its emphasis on rationality, inaugurated by Adorno and Horkheimer, of course preceded by the entire counter-enlightenment in philosophy, is one of the principles or the contemporary basis of postmodern theory's anti-enlightenment project. So I think that, in particular, Dialectic of Enlightenment, the book, and that critique of reason, in particular instrumental reason, is instrumental and has been instrumental and has had it in the thinking of the postmodern theorists who we treat down the line a little while here. Critical theory inspired numerous other critical approaches as well, all of which began from the same premises that the Western political heritage and foundations were exploitative and oppressive at base, and that emancipation required a negative dialectical approach to negate these foundations. Okay, so they undertook a continuation of what Marx called a ruthless criticism of everything existing. They follow in the Marxist line in that way, particularly. It's not that they're orthodox Marxists by any stretch, and they even abandoned the working class as the agent for political and economic revolution. They nevertheless continued that same program of ruthless criticism that Marx referred to in their work. Some of the followers, and only some of the followers of critical theory include, and these are somewhat departments or fields of thought, critical race theory, critical legal studies, and critical whiteness studies. These fields of study and programs of thought and political programs, I have they can be found in the glossary that is attached to the course. And I'll talk about them briefly here. Critical race theory takes the ideas of the Frankfurt School and imports them into a discussion of race. And in particular, they see race as an all-determining totality that defines all the parts within society. Race is not some element within the system. It becomes the defining character of the system itself. Everything is racially inflected, at least, if not utterly determined. So critical race theory is the belief that race is the all-determining, totalizing factor of the social order, and that it has to be ruthlessly treated in every regard, in every aspect, in all of its manifestations. Critical legal studies takes the same approach into the legal field. It takes up defense and promotion of the subordinate, so-called, in particular, the racially subordinate. And it sees the entire legal system in terms of that. It says that the entire legal system itself is racist at the core, that all of American legal, the whole entire legal foundation of the U.S. and elsewhere is racist, including the Constitution. And for that, they would point to the contradictions between the Declaration of Independence and the coexistence of slavery. Instead of saying and using, in fact, while using, I should say, the premises of liberal, you know, classical liberal views or principles that are in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they use them to indict the entire edifice instead of saying, let's apply these same principles equally across the board. Let's live up to these principles. They denounce the principles while using them. That's a very curious development. They don't apparently see the contradiction, and therefore they were able to indict everything at once instead of saying, look, we actually have the principles they derived from this Western liberal democratic standpoint and viewpoint, and the whole tradition of Western classical liberalism. Instead of saying this is something to resuscitate, to apply across the board, this is something to utterly denounce and to oppose and to abolish and demolish. The same goes for critical whiteness studies. Whiteness is not this aspect of some parts of the social body. It is the all-determining, totalizing character of the social body. Everything is impacted by whiteness, ways of life, attitudes. Every element of the social body is determined by this whiteness that has to be eradicated. And then, of course, some people see this and interpret it as an ethno-cleansing type of a program, that they want to eradicate white people. Well, that's a leap. And I would say that's a bit of a leap because they see this whiteness as an abstraction. Now, there will have to be some white people sacrificed in the effort to eradicate whiteness. That is true. But they abstract from society this thing called whiteness and then try to attack it wherever it manifests. If it's irredeemably manifest in certain individuals, then those individuals, yes, will be sacrificed, either mortally or otherwise socially destroyed. But nevertheless, whiteness is the object of attack. Those terms, as I said, can be found in the glossary attached to the course. Thus, it would not be wrong to figure the Black Lives Matter movement, for example, as one of the legatees of critical theory, because they import critical race theory and critical whiteness theory into their program, both of which demonstrably derived from the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. What we're living through in the U.S. is no less than a cultural and, in many sense, a political revolution made possible in no small part by the Frankfurt School of Critical Theory. And thus we wrap up our conclusion of the Frankfurt School itself. Thank you.